How nice to be here with all my friends. I don't know if any of you noticed, but... I should say that I'm not Tim Burkett. I think everyone here knows that, but maybe not. Tim was supposed to give the talk today, and he is not feeling well. So he called me and asked me to sit in for him. My name is Ben Connolly. So I noticed something really wonderful happened just a few minutes ago. I was up in the office and I was looking out the window, which was very nice already. And I was listening to Leo playing the shakuhachi. And the doorbell rang. Is that right? And the doorbell rang, and the doorbell has a chime. Da-na-na-na. And on the next note, Leo came in on exactly the same note the doorbell came in on. What's that?
I planned that.
He actually paid someone to ring the doorbell. So... I just thought this was interesting because the question isn't really the intention of whether Leo thought, oh, I'll come in on this note with the doorbell. The question is Leo's lifelong intention to devote himself to the shakuhachi, to allow himself without any thought to come in at exactly the same time on the note that was coming in on the chime. That, to me, is the essence of Zen practice. We devote ourselves lifelong, and then over and over, we find ourselves able to accord with the circumstance that arisen harmoniously. Thank you, Leo. Today, I'm going to talk a little bit about the song of the grassroots hermitage. Actually, I'm going to talk a lot, but I'm going to talk a little bit of the poem. The poem is quite long, and it's probably more appropriate for a multi-part class or a large book, because it is it's full of beautiful teaching. And I thought of doing this because... it's so nice when we do Sesshin here, which is our formal retreat. We get to chant the Song of the Grassroots Hermitage before lunch, which I love. So on Sundays we have almost no Japanese-style ritual, although we do a short chant before and after the Dharma talk, and sometimes we bow, probably as much out of habit as out of the intent of our teacher, Tim, who keeps telling us not to bow on Sundays. But when we do our morning practice during the week, Monday through Thursday, and when we do Sesshin, we really follow the Japanese monastic forms pretty closely. Some people like to do that, so they do more of that. Some people don't, so they do less. Some people don't like to do it, so they do it anyway to challenge themselves. That was one of the first things I ever heard Tim say when I came here 9 years ago. Was that if I didn't like the traditional practice, I should go do that. That would be good for me. So... when we chant, this is one aspect of formal Japanese monastic practice. Chanting is, in a way, it's singing. We chant together on a single pitch. The men sing the lower octave and the women sing the upper octave. We chant in a very simple rhythm. There's no denying that the music around here isn't the most invigorating emotive music you've ever heard. And I think that's by design. When we chant, the idea isn't to demonstrate expressive qualities within ourselves. It's not to show any idiosyncratic elements of ourselves. I was thinking about this the other day, so I just wanted to give you a demonstration of. Let's see. May our intention equally penetrate every being and place with the true merit of Buddha's way. So we value in America individualism, and arguably in Japan and China, where Zen comes from, individualism, individuality is less valued. But this really isn't about culture. This is about practice. And if there's one beautiful thing that can happen in practice is that your individual sense of self can be relaxed, and your sense of universal connection can grow. And so we express this in the way that we chant, which is simple and it's austere. That's true, but it's also beautiful. I'm talking about this because this thing is called the Song of the Grassroots Hermitage. So that made me curious. I could find no scholarship. I didn't do that much research, but I did a fair amount. Was this poem that we're going to talk about today ever sung in like a melody? Was that the original intent? I have no idea. I know that we chant it, and chant is related to song. But it's beautiful to just read without chanting also, which we'll do. Chanting is, more than anything, in my opinion, an activity of listening. So usually you might think, if I'm going to say, beings are numberless, vowing to free them, that what this is about singing. But it's more about listening. It's about listening to the sound that is emerging from this body, listening to the sounds that are emerging from the bodies around me. Avalokiteshvara is a bodhisattva of compassion, which probably a lot of people here know about. What that means, it's she's a symbol, or he, oh gosh, it changes. Am I right about that? Okay, good. a symbol or an embodiment of compassion. And you can find in ancient Asian art all these depictions of Avalokiteshvara. And very frequently, Avalokiteshvara is displayed as having an eye. She has many, many hands, and all these hands are devoted completely to attending to people. As all these hands, because the universal compassionate activity of the universe is expressed through Avalokiteshvara. So there's all these hands constantly enacting, helping people. But in each hand, there is an eye. Because perception and activity are not two things. Now, this is not the conventional way that we view our experience. Normally, we are going to view our experience principally through the idea that we are doing something. I'm getting there, I'm getting this done. And one of the first backward steps we take when we do Zazen and we do Zen practice is to devote ourselves more wholeheartedly to just observing. And, you know, you might, if you go, whoa, all I'm doing is sitting. I'm not doing anything. I'm just observing. That's what Zazen is. Just observation with no activity. That's clearly not really true because you're sitting. You're breathing. You're probably thinking. But what we're looking to get to is this position where activity and perception are not two. And in chanting, I think most people attend more to activity. Probably in part to self-consciousness. You're like, oh, shoot, am I singing right? Or you used to sing when you hear music, you think, oh, I'm going to express myself. You know, so that's kind of a natural inclination. So for most of us, when we chant, it's good to bring more of our attention to the listening. So we lean a little bit to the side of perception. And that will enable us to hear our friends who are with us. That's also true outside of chanting, by the way. So what I'm talking about is that the activity and the practice of chanting are the same as the activity and the practice of living as expressed in Zen. Just to be available to what's happening here and yet active. And although it may not appear like that's what's happening in Zazen, I believe it to be so. So I'm going to pass out these chant books because we're going to do this together. Probably fun. You can send some of those around. We're probably going to need a few more. Let's send these little light ones around. And if we don't have enough, no, we'll have enough. How are we doing? We need some more back there. How many? Could you put up hands if you don't have one? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. I think I got everyone. Oh, could you send those back, please? So you can look through, probably in the book it will say, there's a tab in the black ones, I think, that say midday for most of them, and at the midday service it has the Song of the Grassroots Hermitage. In the blue books, I think it's just the second page. So I don't know what Shitu, who was a 8th century Chinese Zen practitioner, was thinking when he wrote this, but I know we usually chant it before lunch during sesshin when you've been sitting for a few hours, and so that always informs my experience. So when we're chanting, if we don't have a chant book, like if you have a chant memorized, we chant in gassho with the fingers in front of the nose. But when we have a chant book, we usually hold them. I don't have a book. Someone can show how we do this. With three fingers outside the book page and two inside, like this. And why do we do this? When we're doing these formal practices, we do it so specifically. And arguably, this is because this is the way culture works in Asia. They like to do things very specifically in Japan. But more importantly, we don't have a lot of different mindfulness practices in Zen. So we have very specific ways of doing things to help us attend to what we're doing. So this is why, in a Vipassana tradition, you have lots of different types of meditation. We don't have lots of different types of meditation. We have hold the book. Hold the book like this. And then we can pay attention and just be in our lives. So let's chant this together. When chanting, it's good to just listen to the person who's leading the chant, who's usually called the Doan, but I'll lead this one. And hear their pitch and then come in when you feel comfortable. And then I would just say try and accord with the sound of our voices all together. Song of the Grass Roof Hermitage. I've built a grass hut where there's nothing of value. After eating, I relax and enjoy a nap. When it was completed, fresh weeds appeared. Now it's been lived in, covered by weeds. The person in the hut lives here calmly, not stuck to inside, outside, or in between. Places worldly people live, he doesn't live. Rural's lovely people love, he doesn't love. Though the hut is small, it includes the entire world.
In 10 square feet, an old man illumines forms and their nature. A great vehicle, Bodhisattva, trusts without doubt. The middling or lowly can't help wondering, will this hut perish or not? Perishable or not, the original master is present, not dwelling south or north, east or west. Firmly based on steadiness, it can't be surpassed. A shining window below the green pines, jade palaces or vermilion towers can't compare with it. Just sitting with head covered, all things are at rest. Thus this mountain monk doesn't understand at all. Living here, he no longer works to get free. Who would proudly arrange seats trying to entice guests? Turn around the light to shine within, then just return. The vast, inconceivable source can't be faced or turned away from. Meet the ancestral teachers, be familiar with their instruction. Bind grasses to build a hut and don't give up. Let go of hundreds of years and relax completely. Open your hands and walk innocent. Thousands of words, myriad interpretations are only to free you from obstructions. If you want to know the undying person in the hut, do not separate from this skin bag here and now.
All right, you can put the books away. You can just put them down. We'll collect them later. Thank you for chanting with me. That's fun. I realize that last line, just there's one element of it that's got to seem strange to people who haven't been around here. So I wasn't going to talk about the last line, but this, do not separate from this skin bag here and now. Could anything be more inspiring than that? It's funny because this poem uses a rhetoric, a kind of a rhetoric which is common to Zen, which includes a lot of irony, which means saying one thing when you're meaning another. But usually Zen irony means saying one thing when you're meaning that thing and you're meaning the opposite. So normally we think of irony as just saying like, yeah, you're real smart, when you mean you're stupid. Yeah, you got that. But in this case, Zen irony is usually about saying both things at the same time. But also the same linguistic impulse to confound and confuse a little bit, to put the mind that thinks it's got everything figured out a little off its footing, is used in various ways. So, do not separate from this skin bag here and now. Now, he could have said, do not separate from this luminous body here and now. And maybe that would have made us all happier. I don't know. Skin bag, in the earliest Buddhism, the human body was really sort of denigrated. And not as extremely as in some Indian monastic traditions, but it really, you know, they were not super into this. They were into, because they realized that people tend to be so attached to the preservation of their body and their physical comfort that they're constantly creating need out of that. And so if you want to go beyond needing, if you want to enter an unconditional joy, that a joy that doesn't have to have any external thing to satisfy it, you have to let go of your attachments to your body. So there's a lot of negativity about the body in early Buddhism, and then that really becomes much less prevalent after several hundred years, and it's really not a very popular attitude at all in the United States in Buddhism. But that's kind of where this term skin bag comes from. I think it's like a translation out of the really oldest stuff where they'd say, oh, your body's just a skin bag, you know, go beyond that. So your body is just a skin bag. Go beyond that. But this line says, do not separate from it here and now. So it's the opposite. But why not just say, do not separate from this luminous body or this amazing experience or whatever you want to say, because by saying skin bag, she too points to the fact that our mindfulness, our non-separation from this here and now, this body sensory experience of here and now, can generate a lot of attachment. It can generate a lot of need, and that doesn't really help us if what we're looking to do is move towards stillness, towards peace, towards an unconditional appreciation for life. So he pushes and pulls in this last line. So don't separate from this, but don't become attached to it. Don't separate, but don't become attached. Okay, so I better look at my notes. So the first line of this poem, I've built a grass hut where there's nothing of value. Now, because the first time I heard this, it was like at my first sesshin, and I was at Hokyoji, a place of extraordinary natural beauty, and I'd been meditating, and I felt really good. And I knew this was a Zen poem, and I was like, wow, I built a grass hut where nothing of value. And I could feel a sense of freedom when I first heard that line. I remember that experience. But it's really funny because I was looking at it with sort of fresh eyes when I was going to give this talk, and I was like, boy, if Jean-Paul Sartre, if an existentialist had written this line, what would it mean? All this life and all I've built is a grass hut where there's nothing of value. I've become so accustomed to the idea of this line as expressing something beautiful about freedom that I've forgotten its ironic intent to point out a sort of a futility. Who wants futility? I don't want it. But yet again, she too is saying, don't get stuck on what I'm going to talk about here. Don't get stuck on what I'm talking about here. What I've built, what I, Zen Master Shitu, who will be one of the most influential teachers in the history of Zen, what I've built is nothing but a grass hut where there's nothing of value. A grass hut. Now, I read that and I think, you obviously do not live in Minnesota. But, people lived in Minnesota, or what is now Minnesota, for thousands of years in impermanent skin dwellings, teepees, and wigwams. And there may still be some people living like that. So I built a grass hut where there's nothing of value also points towards a certain lack of material acquisitiveness, which I think is valued in our tradition, probably less valued in our tradition in the United States than it is in Asia. But I think it's important to remember that many of the greatest exemplars of our tradition possessed almost nothing. The earliest practitioners of Buddhism possessed pretty much a change of clothing, a bowl, a couple other things. I'm not going that road, and I don't know anyone who has. But at the same time, realizing that attachment to material possessions principally creates suffering for us is kind of an interesting perspective. That it runs pretty contrary to not only most American culture, but really our own lives, I think. And I think it's a good reminder to me to simplify. To simplify, and when I see, like, you know, I go by the Apple store, and they have big displays, and everyone in there looks really cool, and it looks cool in there, and I'm like, wow, look at that iPhone, and, like, that can, I could see someone. Wow, it's like the Jetsons are here, right? That technology in particular, it's incredible. I read some anthropological studies where they went down, you know, they were in the jungles in Borneo or something, and people had, you know, their technology was Stone Age, but they, like, brought some, they brought some Walkmans in there, and man, those people, as soon as they got that Walkman, they were like, I love my Walkman. I love my Walkman. And they would listen to their Walkman, and then when their Walkman broke, they were like, I got to make some money, because I need another Walkman. And they weren't making any money before. They were just gathering as they had been for probably 25,000 years. So, I don't know what exactly I'm saying here, but this is just an interesting thing to pay attention to. Because it's just, most of the time, it's like once we get a new technology, we immediately get used to it. We immediately get used to it. And then a little while later, someone presents us something. Oh, you're going to need this. Maybe everyone does. Everyone you know has this thing. And then, oh, I got to have that. And we get so used to it. What is that? Then we need the other thing. So this is just something to pay attention to. I'm not like, you know, selling my house and moving into a grass hut. But it's interesting. On a arguably, on another level, he says, I've built a grass hut. The hut, he's not building something that's going to last very long. You know, it's not like I've built a vast temple to Buddhism that houses 1,000 monks. Now, wouldn't that be a nice poem to write? If you were, you know, that makes sense. But that's not what we're talking about here. What he's done is he's built something that he knows will never last. Basic idea in Buddhism, nothing lasts. Nothing. So as long as we're trying to build things that we think are going to last, we're working in the world of denial. And so we have to do these kind of logical leaps to try and make that work. And it keeps coming up as suffering because it's like, oh, I wanted that to last, but it didn't. You know, this thing that was so important to me, this device that I acquired that I thought, this is going to bring me lasting happiness. I don't even notice it anymore. It doesn't bring me happiness. I only get annoyed when it doesn't work. Right? I mean, how many times do you hear someone say, man, I love this iPhone, relative to, dang, I just can't get a connection. How fast did that happen? That we have this kind of technology. Wow. So, I built this thing, it's not going to last. That's cool. I built a grass hut where there's nothing of value. This is maybe, I think this part about nothing of value is very interesting. Because this is Zazen. This is what Zazen is. To build a grass hut where there's nothing of value. We do something, but it's impermanent, clearly. Anyone who's done a lot of Zazen knows that you'll do a lot of Zazen and it's quite wonderful, and then you get up and then something happens that is quite not Zazen to you. You know that whatever peace is made in Zazen is not something that you just hold on to and it's like a diamond. It's totally ephemeral. Where there's nothing of value, this is just to sit with what is. when we just breathe, the reason our practice is to just attend to breathing is because generally our mind is ascribing value to things so fast we can't even keep up with it. In Buddhist psychology, there are five aspects of consciousness, the aggregates, form, sensation, perception, formation, and consciousness. Sensation is the judgment that our mind makes between whether we like things, we don't like them, or they don't really matter to us. Positive, negative, or neutral. In early Buddhism, they have meditations for all five aggregates so that you could see and kind of understand and become comfortable with your own consciousness. But the one about sensations is the one people do the least, because your mind generates like and dislike so fast that if you try and meditate, it's like chasing a flock of starlings that lift from a field, thousands of birds, just like that. And see, follow one. It's going so fast. So, this like and dislike, but sometimes, it keeps coming up, this valuation. When you say nothing, this line about nothing of value is about not ascribing value. The idea that things have an inherent value, that's a different issue, but I think, let's not talk about that. We're talking about the value we make for things by wanting them or not wanting them. So sometimes when we're just practicing mindfulness of breath, or maybe we're practicing some other concentration-based meditation, there's just a break in deciding whether we like things or we don't like things. There's nothing of value. Because value is made. And this is the same thing that Tim has been talking about in the heart-mind inscription for a few months. The first line of the heart-mind inscription is, the way is not easy or difficult, just give up picking and choosing. Same thing. Give up picking and choosing. There's nothing of value. But if you just try and, I'm not going to pick and choose, you just did it. So that's why we just breathe. We just sit and breathe. And then this just happens. Just happens. Sometimes there's a moment where we haven't decided whether what's happening is okay with us or not. If I was a religious person, I would say, I don't think God cares that much whether you think it's right or not. It's big. Big. The big picture, that's not what matters. This little interest in figuring out what is valuable to me is so tiny and self-centered. And so when we experience this nothing of value, then there's something much bigger available to us. Also, lastly about this line, this one line of poetry I've been talking about for 20 minutes, this poem is an expression of Shitu's realization. And it's something that people have used to inspire them and lead them in their aspiration for thousands and thousands of years. So what he's talking about throughout the poem is that he has, through his effort, attained a realization, something beautiful and amazing. So the way he says it is, I've built a grass hut where there's nothing of value. Because if he says, I have built an indestructible diamond truth, which some Buddhist texts might say, I've built the indestructible diamond truth, where all things are at rest. Well, then I got to get some of that. So by saying it, using this irony of expressing both the incredible value of what he has found, the incredible beauty of what he's found, and the complete lack of value to it. He offers you both sides and suggests that you don't get stuck on getting attached to it or not caring. The next line is perhaps, should be the most popular line in all of Zen. After eating, I relax and enjoy a nap. And I just love this. This poem, this is one of the principal themes of this poem. There's the line, after eating, I relax and enjoy a nap. Later he says, the person in the hut lives here calmly. Later he says, just sitting with head covered, all things are at rest. Let go of hundreds of years and relax completely. Open your hands and walk innocent. To be at ease in the world is the fruit of the way, and it is the way. The realization that Shitu found is expressed most consistently in saying that there is calmness there, that there is ease. On Saturday mornings when we chant the Metta Sutra, I believe the only repeated line in the Metta Sutra is, may all beings be at ease. And when we do yoga here, we end our yoga with a chant, may all beings be at ease. So, this is a hope that I have for everyone. And it is how I think we are suggested to conduct ourselves in the world, with ease. But interestingly, we are asked to make effort. But the amount of effort you make does not impede the possibility for ease. So, I think this poem is pointing towards a life of activity. The first line is, I built. You know, I'm doing something. But throughout, this activity is done with ease. With ease and quiet joy. And it's done with an awareness that the results of this effort will be impermanent. That they'll keep changing. I built a grass hut where there's nothing of value. After eating, I relax and enjoy a nap. When it was completed, fresh weeds appeared. Fresh weeds appear. This is the way. What are you going to do with them? You're going to see them? You're going to put them in your value system? I don't like them. I do like them. I'm a really cool person because I do like weeds. Oh, I'm going to pick up the weeds. Just see them. Weeds. Wow. I think that's what I have to say for today. Thank you. And I would like to request that you express yourselves through observations or questions.
Sure. I'd like to get back to the skin bag.
Me too.
Right. And I can say this, I think there maybe are only one or two people in this room whose particular skin bags have been around longer than mine, not very many. So when I hear the phrase skin bag, what I think of is aging, decay, impermanence. And not separating from that means, well, not separating from that process. So it's not so much a question of denigrating the body, but it's accepting the fact that it's decaying. But ironically enough, the thing that gives me the greatest joy in not separating is dance, because you just totally commit to the body doing what you need to do, accepting the fact that it's never going to be right, but you do it anyway.
Thank you.